Is this, yeah, this works. This works, right. If you all walk to A212, you can probably see the slides. For some strange reason, this is, it says here, send the builder till A212. So, yeah, I'm not sure how to proceed now. It's impossible to give a presentation while you can't see the presentation. No, this the one, some of them are, but not all. I had something on grading of the first assignment, which is rather important, and I have something on the third assignment, which is not available in Blackboard yet. I can see if I can start with the first regular presentation, and then we'll see how we can solve this. Asaru? No, forget it. I want an element of surprise to be in there. What I will do is I'll go to the denial of service attacks presentation, and I will try to do this from a piece of paper, and then for those who have it available, then apologies for that. I will have a nice chat with IT right after this. Where is the presentation? Okay. Denial of service attacks. That's chapter 7 in the book. We'll go there. Okay. Let me start something else. We have been talking about crypto. We have been talking about authentication before the holiday break. After this break, there will be another few topics. One will be network security. We'll spend 2 weeks on that. Then there will be a bit about system securities, a couple of weeks on that, and then some remaining topics like critical infrastructure security and IDSs. For the network security, there are a number of chapters in the book that you will have to read. Initially, I intended chapter 7, chapter 22, 23, and 24, and a guest lecture also next week, but that's going to be too much. So I decided to skip the presentation, to skip chapter 24 on wireless security. So that will be out now. That means less for you to study. Today I will go into chapter 7, and I will go into chapter 23, and then next week I will deal with chapter 22, and there will be a guest lecture on Heartbleed. Okay, so that as a administrative part. Let's see, denial of service attacks. What does that mean? Again, I follow as much as possible, maybe also on administrative information. In the beginning, on crypto, on authentication, I followed a little bit the book, specifically on chapter 3, but I had a lot of my own presentations. From now on, I will follow the book more closely. Maybe not go into detail on each and every detail that you can read in the book. It's your task also to read the material beforehand, if possible. I will try to announce it better. It would be interesting after the course to get feedback from you which actually way of teaching you preferred. Me making my own slides and you using the book as background information, or following the book more closely. Now, this is the first time that I'm teaching this course, so I'm also a bit looking on what to do. Yeah, so feedback on that would be appreciated. I guess that's the most thing that I wanted to say now. Let's go to actually chapter 7 then. So we'll start with what is in fact a denial of service attack. In principle, denial of service is what it says that it is. a server tries to, or a person tries to run a service for other people, maybe a web server or whatever, and that service will be made unavailable through this particular attack. And there is a NIST definition here: a denial of service, or DOS, is an action that prevents or impairs the authorized use of network systems or applications by exhausting resources such as central processing unit, memory, bandwidth, and disk space. And so there are various ways to execute a DOS attack, and there are various ways to execute it on. So it doesn't need to be just on the bandwidth or something like that. It can also be on disk space or anything else. Okay. As said, resources that can be attacked. There are three different resources that you can attack. There is the... let me see if I can do something here. No, they can't see in E212 either. They should not. Okay. The most obvious and probably the most used in a DOS attack is attacking the network bandwidth. So every organization has in principle a limited, might be a large amount, but it has a limited amount of bandwidth available between the organization and the ISP, and then it goes over the regular internet. Yeah, if I make sure that bandwidth, which is seen as the information highway, if there is a traffic jam on that information highway, yeah, traffic will not flow as it should be. So the idea there is to make sure that there is so much traffic on the lines that regular traffic is in effect blocked from reaching the destination. System resources. There we try to, or they try to, crash a system or overload a system. So the amount of traffic is not that much of importance. But maybe open connections, maybe table searches or something like that. And application resources, an attack on the application resources, sending a valid request that takes a lot of processing time on the attacked system. So for example, if you do a large database search on an attacked system, and you do a lot of them, maybe not an extreme lot, but the sufficient lot, all of this will consume some computing power, but then the total amount of computing power is growing so much that regular tasks can't be dealt with. Then a nice animated slide on a classical denial of service attack. So we have a network, we have the internet in the middle, and then we have a number of local area networks. And then you'll see that from one area, we are attacking another area, for example, by a ping. And if we send a lot of pings, then hopefully the bandwidth between the ISP and the attacked web server will just clog up. Every time that a ping is sent, there is also a request. That depends on the protocol, but if you send a ping, then there will be a reply back. Again, eating up more of the bandwidth that is available. But normally, the ping goes back to the one that is sending the ping, or the ping reply is going back to the one sending the ping. So if I'm attacking somebody and I'm sending a lot of ping requests to a particular server, yeah, then at some point people see that all of these ping requests come from a particular IP address, and so that's probably the person attacking. So that might not be that smart, but anyway, it will clog up the internet from the bandwidth of the attack system. In order to not be so visible as an attacker, there is something called source address spoofing. So I'm sending out a message to a particular IP address, but the source IP address, I spoof that. I'll just replace that by something else. Yeah, so that at least it's not that easy to trace the attack back to myself. And so I choose probably random IP address or something like that. That means that the reply from the attack system is not going back to just one IP address, one source, but it is spreading over the internet to all these sources that I have spoofed. If such a system is sitting there and all of a sudden gets a reply to a ping while it never sent out a ping, either it drops the particular message or it will send back an error message. And if it sends back an error message, it will in fact add to the attack, because again, that is sent to the address that I'm attacking, and so there's even more information going there. The main reason to do source address spoofing is to make sure that I am not visible. So if somebody is investigating the attack, at least they cannot trace it back to me. Then there is something called egress filtering. In principle, what we don't want is these kinds of attack. We don't want people to be able to spoof their IP address, a source IP address, such that they are not visible for people to see them. And so what can be done is, if at a particular ISP from a network, when the network connects to an ISP and then is going further on to the internet address, if there's something coming with a source IP address that is actually not from this particular network, it just should drop this. It's relatively easy to check. Yeah, is the message coming from my network actually identifiable as something from a network, or does it look like it's coming from another network? If it looks like it's coming from another network, there's no good reason to do that. Apparently there's something strange going on. We should drop that. Your own ISP should drop that particular packet already. Unfortunately, this kind of filtering out is not commonplace. Should be done, but it is not. So then a nice animation of that particular process. Again, I am sending a lot of ping requests to to the attack system, but with spoofed IP addresses. And so when the attack system is responding, it sends out all these replies to different locations, and then hopefully, for me as an attacker, those systems that just get a reply to a ping that they never send, they will send back an error message also. And so adding again to the amount of bandwidth that is consumed in this attack. So that's the classical DOS denial of service attack that we consider. Then there is something called SYN spoofing attack. If you want to set up a connection in TCP, what happens is you first send a SYN packet to the server, so the client sends it to the server. The server receives it, he sends back a SYN ACK, and then when the client receives that, it sends an acknowledgement on that also back to the server. So there is a three-way step there. For example, we could play that game here. I would say to somebody, how are you? I'm Patrick, how are you? And you'll reply back to me, I'm fine, how are you? And I will say, I'm fine. Yeah? But if all of a sudden I'll tell you, I am Jürgen, how are you? You will ask Jürgen how he is. You're saying to him how you are, and then, you get something strange going on there. And if I don't reply, you will just say again, I'm fine, how are you? That's the idea in the setup of a TCP connection. And so the SYN spoof attack uses this, and what it does is, I'll send you the SYN message. You get that? You are a nice web server, so what you do is you reply with the SYN ACK. And I don't do anything anymore. And because you don't get an answer to my SYN ACK, you don't get the acknowledgement to the SYN ACK, you say, oh, maybe it dropped somewhere. I'll send it again. I'll wait a bit. Well, nothing. I'll send it again. And you repeat that a couple of times. So all of that time that I don't react to your SYN ACK, actually that particular source on the attack system is in use. It can't be used for anything else. So after a while, this server will just say, okay, apparently something is wrong here, I will drop this connection. But until then, the connection is held in some kind of hostage situation. Yeah, I can keep a connection alive for a while just by simply not sending the acknowledgement at the very end. Yeah, so that's the SIN spoofing attack. Yeah? Now you're trying to defend against his attack, right? Or sorry, who has the full compliance with the RFC, the web server or the web client? Okay. I must admit I'm not that detailed. I don't have that detailed knowledge, but this is the common way of doing the attack. That's the one that I tried to describe. Yeah. Let's have a look at a particular set of attacks, which is called flooding attacks. They're different kind of types. The general idea of a flooding attack is to flood, for example, the bandwidth or the server's capability to answer to particular request. So to answer to the to respond to the traffic. So one of the things that we already more or less discussed is sending so much information that packages can't get through and they get dropped along the way. If the amount of traffic at some point is way more than the regulator, so the attack traffic is way more than the regular traffic, that's the goal in this attack, then and there is a flooding, then at some point packets will get dropped. Yeah, and if out of for every regular packet I have 100 attack packets, yeah, and if they drop, let's say 10 or 15 or 20 packets or maybe 50 packets or 190 packets, it's very likely that regular packet is also dropped. Yeah, so there's also attack traffic drop. I don't care. I'm just sending as much as I can. And I don't care what's happening with that. I just want to clog the connection. Yeah, but as soon as packets starts getting dropped, it's very likely that regular traffic is included in that. And so that's the goal. Yeah, because now regular traffic can't reach the server. I have, a successful denial of service attack. Some of these regular packets might make its way through, but that will just be a small portion. Different attacks: ICMP, UDP, TCP, SYNFLOT. So depending on the protocol that is used. So let's see what kind of flooding we have. We have ICMP flooding, often done with ping. But other types of packet can also be used. And the idea is that ping is often allowed into a network because it's used for diagnostics. Yeah, so I'm not sending something that is anyway not going into the network. I'm sending something that can go into the network because on a regular basis people need ping to do some testing. Yeah, so then I can just send a lot of ping requests and I'm just clogging up the traffic. UDP, again, I have to find a UDP port that is in general open for traffic. So again, some kind of analysis, some kind of diagnostic services, and I'm sending a lot of packets there to make sure that no other traffic is available, can get through to the server. And then TCP SYNFLOT is different from the previous attack that I said, where I want to have open connections that cannot be used by somebody else. But here in TCP and flood, I'm again sending as much information as possible, as many setting up as many connections as possible, so that the traffic again it has such a high volume that other traffic can't get through. Um, Attacks by a single system are not effective and are easy to trace. Well, why is that? Because I am sending all that information. And first of all, if I don't do source IP address spoofing, it can be traced back to me. And I'm using up my own bandwidth also. Yeah, so if I'm a large company attacking a small company, so with a large bandwidth attacking somebody with a small bandwidth, that's possible. But otherwise, I would be attacking myself also. So using a large number of systems makes the attack more powerful. Yeah, but we have to see how we can do that. So for that, we will use what is called a distributed denial of service attack. So not a single denial of service coming from a single source, but I'm trying to use as many sources as possible. An attacker controls in a DDoS attack, an attacker controls a large amount of other systems. And they are grouped together in what is called a botnet. And in that botnet, you have the system of the attacker, and that system controls a number of zombies. And some of these zombies are used to do the direct attack. Some of these zombies are used to control other zombies. So me as an attacker, I don't need to control everybody, all of the zombies. No, I'll just have some kind of hierarchy such that I can control a zombie that controls a number of other zombies that can do the attack. And in this way, there is, if the botnet is large enough, there can be an attack from many different systems. And even though the amount of attack from each of these systems might be small, relatively small, still the total amount is of traffic will be large because of the amount of zombies in the botnet. Two rather known attacks, Tribe Flood Network, TFN, from the, 1990s, that exploited a weakness in the Solaris system. And then the follow-up of that, the Tribe Flood Network 2000, that actually also run on Unix and Windows NT. And these are common known examples of distributed denial of service attacks. More, of course, are known also. In both cases, they use a two-layer command hierarchy. So the attacker is controlling a number of zombies that is controlling a number of different zombies that then attack. So it's a relatively flat hierarchy. Different kinds of attacks possible. No source spoofing is used then. No source spoofing was used in the Tribe-Flood network. Why? Because if I have many different systems that I can control, the source IP addresses are manifold anyway, and so it doesn't point back to a single system anyway. So there was no need for the attacker to hide himself or to hide the zombies in his botnet. Communication between the handler zombie and the agent zombie. So the handler zombie is the zombie that controls a number of zombies that really do the attack, and the agent zombie was doing the attack. That traffic in TFN was in fact encrypted. And it was intermixed with other traffic, such that this communication between the zombie handler and the zombie agent could not be monitored. And so this is an attack that is, in many ways, much more effective, because I just have to control a number of zombie handlers, and they will do all the rest. Yeah, so if my botnet is large enough, if I have control over as many zombies as is needed for a particular attack, I can easily do that. It's safe in the sense that it doesn't really trace back directly to me, and the traffic that is used between these zombies is anyway, let's say, hidden. Yeah, well hidden. That's always up for discussion. Okay. Then we have application-based bandwidth attacks. As an example, we have the SIP protocol, which is used in IP online. example of an application here, the idea is to force the target to perform resource-consuming actions. And then if we look at this this picture, we see that the attack system is sending an... The SIP invite, which is a part of this of the SIP protocol, that is something that will apparently consume a considerable amount of resources on the attack system, on the proxy server of the attack system. And so if I make sure that I send as many SIP invites as possible with spoofed many spoofed invite requests, so it looks like it's coming from different sources, then all of these SIP invites will consume a lot of resources on the proxy, and that means that the proxy will at some point run out of its resources. So SIP is SIP SIP flood is one of the attacks. Another one is the HTTP based attack. What we could do there, HTTP is the normal web protocol, web browser protocol. What we could do there is just see if we can download or upload large amounts, large files, and so see if we can use the resources in this particular way. Consumes memory to store the intermediate results. Consumes processing and transmission resources. Then there was an attack called SlowLoris, which is using this HTTP attack, and they misuse the fact that actually an HTTP request ends with an empty line, with a blank line. Yeah, so I've sent a request, but I don't send a blank line. The request will hang for a while until there is some kind of timeout, but until I can for a particular amount of time, I can just make sure that some of the resources are blocked for other users, just by sending incomplete requests to this server. Yeah. At some point, there will be a timeout or something like that, and then the resource will become available. But if I send as many of these requests as possible, then many of these resources will be unavailable for a long period of time, and then once they get available, hopefully because of the amount of traffic that I'm sending, the newly available resources will again go to my fake request instead of a real request. Two other sets of attacks are the reflector and the amplifier attack. Normally when I send a request to a DNS server, I'll ask something. When I send a request to a DNS server, what I will do is I will say something about When I send a request to the DNS server, what I have to do is tell where this request comes from. That comes from me, I want the answer back. So I have to give my own source IP address. And so what is done in this particular attack is, again, spoof the IP, the source IP address, such that the reply of the DNS server will go to a different address. So if I then, as the source IP address, give the IP address of the attacked system, then the DNS server will send the message to the attacked system. And so if I use many DNS servers or many requests to these DNS servers, all these different DNS servers will send their reply to the attack system. And again, a lot of traffic is generated to the attack system. On top of that, the attack system might get a reply to request it never did. It might send back some kind of an error message or some kind of other message. Again, adding to the amount of traffic that is coming and going to this particular attack system. And so the idea here is to use as many DNS servers as possible. This is called a reflector attack because actually I am sending something to a DNS server in this particular case, and the attack is reflecting off and being sent to the attacked system. Yeah, so I'm not attacking the attacked system directly. I'm using another server for that. The amplifier attack is actually making sure that I send a small request to a reflector, to another server system, again with a spoofed IP address, and the answer of that particular request will send a larger amount of information. Normally, it would go back to the system requesting this, but because I use a spoofed IP address, it will send a large amount of information to the attacked system in this particular case. Yeah, and again, using zombies in a DDoS attack means that I can really make sure that there is a huge amount of information going to the attacked system. For example, in the DNS protocol, apparently a 60-byte UDP request can be extended up to 512 bytes UDP response. So it gets like 8 times as big. So for every 60 bytes that I send, the attack system will receive 512 bytes. So meaning that I can actually amplify the amount of traffic that is going to is being sent there. So there are various ways of using an attack against, using a denial of service attack against an attack system. The question, of course, is how can we defend? I can never prevent somebody trying to do a DOS attack or distributed DOS attack. Yeah, but the system should respond in a good way to that, in the sense that it doesn't just clog up, it doesn't get offline or whatever. So how can we defend? There are 4 lines of defenses against a DDoS attack. So first of all is, before anything happens, we can see if we can prevent some attack or preemption of the attack. The second one is, once an attack is going on, I can see if I can detect what attack is going on, and I can see if particular traffic can be filtered out such that the attack becomes less effective. Also during and maybe also after the attack, I can see if I can identify who was attacking me, so if I can identify the source. And of course, how to act after that the attack has finished, to see if what kind of procedures might need updating or what kind of systems need updating. So if we first look at prevention. So I said if it's a DOS attack or maybe even a DDoS attack, there could be source IP spoofing. Yeah, so very easy, not so much the attack system, but very easy, the ISPs could already detect source IP spoofing and remove that kind of traffic. But that's not something that the attack system can do itself. Alternatively, ensuring that the path for the request and response are the same. So even though the source IP address is spoofed, I still make sure that the answer is not going to the spoofed IP address, but it's going back the same way that it came. That could also be something. Defenses against flood attacks needs to be in the internet cloud, not at the boundary router of the target. Obviously, then it's too late. All that traffic is hurtling in, so. Yeah, you should have been defending before that already. It should not even enter the internet. In a normal operation, the fraction of diagnostic type packets should be small. So yes, ping is needed for analyzing the network, but that's just a limited amount of traffic. Maybe maybe planned at regular intervals or something like that. So if all of a sudden there is 90% of the traffic is pings. Yeah, that is something strange going on. Yeah. So setting a limit on the number of such packets that can get into the network, and then say, okay, I have my bandwidth. Limited amount of that bandwidth is used for these diagnostic type of packets, and the remainder is used for normal packets, normal traffic. SYN spoofing, as said in the beginning, SYN spoofing is just I send a SYN packet, and then I don't react to the request anymore, and then it keeps the connection alive for a while until it's dropped. So a way to handle that is maybe using a modified version of the algorithm, of the protocol, in which actually the connection is not kept alive, but some kind of information is stored. And then when there is a reply, that information is retrieved again and the connection is made. So not keeping open connections. Can be done always, or that can be done at a time when the number of available connections is getting low. So there is a large number of available connections. There's a connection table. Once that connection table starts to fill up, I could go over to this particular way of storing the connection. Storing the connection obviously will take more resourcing power, so I don't want to use that all of the time. Alternative is to drop an incomplete connection in case of table overflow. Once I see that my connection table is getting full and there are a lot of incomplete connections there, that could be an indication. And then I could just start dropping from the top the ones that are the oldest, the incomplete ones that are the oldest, and making sure that the time that I keep a connection alive just gets shorter. I drop them quicker. Other alternative is changing parameters like the size of the TCP connection table. There should be room for that also. It's not always possible. Timeout period for non-responsive entries. That could be entered. That could be changed dynamically. So once you notice that your connection table is starting to overflow, you just change that particular parameter. You can't prevent the attack. You hardly can ever prevent a DDoS attack. But you make it at least harder for the attacker to be successful. Defending against broadcast amplification attack can best be done by blocking IP direct broadcast. You can do that at the ISP or an intermediary or whatever. So making sure that this kind of traffic cannot enter your network, and so you will not see that. Direct connections between human initiated interaction and automated attacks. Using CAPTCHAs, we all know them, where you have to type some letters that are not even human readable anymore nowadays. And you have to show that you're a human by being able to respond to this kind of request. When doing that, making sure that there is a human doing an interaction with the system, you can be sure that you limit the amount of traffic. General security is, but again, that's not on the attack system, avoid compromise of systems to be used as zombies. Obviously, we protect our systems as much as we can. We don't click on links that we don't know. We don't visit strange websites, hopefully. And so hopefully the system will not get infected and can't be used as a zombie. But if my system, if I'm attacking your system, you can't help if my system is infected as a zombie. You can't help that. So as in the system under attack, you don't have control about that. You do have control about replication of servers. So if one server is going down, you can switch, have a hot switch to another server. So that's something that that anyway needs to be in place. If the server is going down because of an attack, or simply because of maybe a power loss or breakdown or whatever, you need backup systems anyway. So what do you do when you're under attack? Well, first of all, you have to contact your ISP. He's the person who's sending you all the traffic. Obviously, you contact him off-band. You can't send him an email. Your bandwidth has been just eaten up, so there will not be many emails going out. So you pick up the phone and you give him a call. You have to detect abnormal traffic. Well, what is abnormal traffic? Well, abnormal traffic is traffic that's not normal. So somehow you have to know what is my normal kind of traffic. What traffic on a regular day, what kind of traffic can I see and can I expect? Yeah, and so anything that is out of the ordinary, if you drop that first, then you hopefully can have as much normal operation as possible. And you will be able to detect, if you detect what is not normal, you can use that information also in trying to trace back the attacker. When you're under a denial of service attack, first try to see what kind of attack. Yeah, if it's a SYN flood, yeah, then you have to do something with your TCP connections. If it's a ICMP attack, yeah, you have to do something with Bing or whatever. Yeah? So you enable to be able to respond to an attack, you have to know what kind of attack you're up against. There is a need for capturing an analysis of packets. Can be done by the organization or by the ISP, but you need that information to be able to determine what kind of attack and what kind of a defense then can be used against this particular attack. And once you have detected what kind of attack is launched against you, you need to use the appropriate filters. Yeah? Different attacks have different filters, so what kind of attack determines what kind of countermeasure is taken. Sometimes a denial of service just uses a bug in a system. Yeah, I know that there is a particular service running here, and it's buggy because if I send this and this particular packet to that server, it will crash. Yeah, okay, then I have to stop that particular service and I have to see if I can fix that bug. Ping of death was one attack there. You can ask the ISP to do also a trace of all the packets in order to see if you can identify the particular attacker. That's not an easy task. Specifically, if you are under some kind of flooding attack, there is a huge amount of traffic going in, and so capturing then analyzing that is just a big task. In case the attack is reported to law enforcement, which is smart anyway, then obviously that kind of captured traffic or part of that captured traffic can be used as evidence. A contingency strategy is needed to be able to be available for a legitimate user. Yeah? If possible, switch over to a server that is on hot standby and see if you can use that. And so even if the attack is still going on and you can't stop it right away, see if you can restore business for the regular users. Afterwards, the attack and the responses need to be analyzed to benefit for potential future attacks, not just for your own company, but also for others, of course. Yeah, that was what I had to say about the denial of service attacks, all very briefly. Any questions on that? Okay. Then I will see if I can get this thing online again. Okay, then we'll have a 15-minute break. Okay. It's a strange illusion, but something was broken apparently. Okay, good. Then I'll quickly continue saying something about the first assignment, about the grading. First, I think I mentioned that already, and I could mention it again for assignment two. Many deliveries on the last day. Generally speaking, I saw good results. There were some issues that I would like to say a few words about. I've seen people using other tools, maybe doing manual decryption, while the assignment was use MATLAB. So, if I ask you to use MATLAB, please use MATLAB. There were many deliveries that were not according to the description in the assignment. So please, if I give you a specific assignment, see if you can stick to that. Some files were renamed in a very strange manner, where I expected .mat files, mod files. I get a .mat file, mat. I'm not sure what happened there. I actually got code in Word files or in text files. I got reports in text files. So I got all kinds of strange things. I can live with that. There was one thing that I would really like to stress for everybody, because that was rather important. Does this ring a bell? Then a miracle occurs. Have you ever seen this picture? This is seen in, let's say, the majority of the assignments. And that's something that is important to mention to everybody. This is the general structure, although it deviated in some cases. People looked at statistical information and said, okay, E and T are the most occurring letters in English, and so I look in the ciphertext, which are the most occurring ciphertext characters there, and so that matches to T and E. And then I looked at the word "the," which is the most occurring word, and see it so many times. So I also have the decryption of the H already available. And then one letter words, that's just I and A. And so I do the matching there also. And then some more is done. And then the key is found. And I can wave my arms all I like, but it doesn't really give information, right? Sometimes, certainly not in all cases. Sometimes the code could give some more information, but you have to realize that in most of the cases you will be graded on your report, so your report should be complete. You can't expect somebody reviewing or grading your paper or your assignment to go into the code and figure out for himself or herself. It doesn't need a lot of writing. You don't have to write complete essays. You don't have to write 10 pages. You can just say, like for the T and the H, I've seen this with a number of deliveries also. Based on this word and the partial decoding, I got these letters. Based on this data. And you can just say, that's 1, 2, 3 lines where you can give all these words, the partially decrypted words already, and then say, okay, so I find this and this and this. Or even say, this matches to this. You don't have to do this on a letter-by-letter level. So with a few more lines, you could have given me the full information. So, yeah, please do that next time. Make sure that your report represents the work that you have done. Is that clear? Maybe a bit too late for assignment two, but at the least it will be useful for assignment three. Okay. So now you have seen. Now you know what then a miracle occurs means. Let me see. Then I have two more presentations. One will be on chapter 23, and I think I'll start with that one. And then I will Yeah. Yeah, I know that, but as I said, it doesn't need to be a complete essay that you write on each and every letter in very many details. If you just say, I saw the word I don't have a pen. Oh, here. So I indeed had a mention, but I had somebody and he looked at, because he had some text saying something, and he saw something like these letters he had already, and then he had the A and the I already, and maybe, yeah, and then two letters, say there was a small X here and a small Y here. I use capitals to show the decrypted ones and small ones. Yeah, so most likely he said, yeah, so if you just in your report said, from this word I got this, that is not a lot of text. I have now explained two letters. If you have a longer word, I've seen where somebody gave a partial decrypted sentence and the result, and that was like 11 letters all of a sudden. Just two words. From this, I find this. Or I assume this. You're not sure, of course. He paid, could also have been here, but that's an assumption. If you see some quotes, you assume that it is he said, and then see if you don't run into trouble. Yeah, so it could be very short. It could just be a few lines. The reason I said short, or I said a half page, I believe. The reason I said short is, yeah, to make sure that I don't have to read, I assume 50 students, that I have to read 7-8 pages per student. That then it really gets a lot of information. Okay, good. Anything more on that? Okay. Let's go quickly to, it's great that you can see this, to internet authentication applications. We'll say a bit about Kerberos. It's a widely used protocol. I will say something about X509 certificates, and I will repeat actually something about PKI, because we have had that before. So first, Kerberos. It's a de facto standard for remote authentication, and actually it's a trusted third party, TTP service. And a trusted third party is a party that is not the sender or the receiver, it's a third party, and it is trusted by the two main parties, by the sender and the receiver. The client and the server trust Kerberos, as I said, it's a trusted third party. And they trust Kerberos to come up with a key that they can use and to do the authentication. Kerberos requires a user to prove his or her identity for each service that they need, and could also do that the other way around. So let's look at the protocol. The Kerberos protocol, the central part is what is called an authentication server. So if I want to get access to a particular server, an application server, I don't authenticate to that application server, but there is a central authentication server that takes care of that. And if both the client and the application server trust that the application server, the Kerberos server, is doing its job in a good manner, and the Kerberos server is at some point saying to the application server, yeah, I authenticated this person, then the application server will just trust on that. The authentication server stores all passwords, all user passwords, obviously not in plain. We have discussed that 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. I mentioned that already, that the authentication server will pass, it says the authentication server will pass this information to the application server. This information server is just means that it says that I checked the identity of this particular person. Doesn't send out passwords or anything to the application server. So it just informs the application server of the result of the authentication. Some security issues. The passwords of the user should be available at the authentication server, or should be able to check by the authentication server. And the authentication validation is sent from the authentication server to the application server. So yeah, that should also be in a sufficiently secure manner that nobody can tamper with that, of course. That's logical. Use of crypto and protocols is done to make sure that that is in a secure manner. This is the Kerberos protocol in a nice short picture. As a user on the left-hand side, as a user, I first contacted Kerberos. I contact the authentication server in Kerberos, and I'll inform that server who I am, and I'll give proof of that. And then I'll say something about an application server that I would like to contact. The authentication server will not give me access to that directly, but it will give me something that I can use to contact what is called a ticket granting server. And that ticket granting server will give me actually the information that I can use to contact the application server. Here is something briefly on the key management. We have a user, we have the application server, the ticket granting server, and the application server. Sorry, the authentication server was the second one, of course. All of these have some information before the Kerberos protocol starts. The user has his own identity. The user has some value T, which will come in later. And the user has some key, K1. And that is actually a shared key between the user and the authentication server. So they have a shared key, they can set up a secure communication. The authentication server obviously has that shared key with the user, but he also has a shared key with the ticket granting server, while the ticket granting server only has a shared key beside that K3. He has a shared key with the application server. And so this is already pre-shared. That's the basis. That's where we start. But in the very end, the user wants to be able to connect in a secure manner to the application server, and so he needs a shared key with the application server. So the first step was that the user identifies himself to the authentication server, so he sends his identity and proof of the identity in with the use of the password. It's a full protocol. It's not here and there. But once the authentication server, once AS has checked the correctness of the identity, he will send back, he will generate a key, K2, and he will send that back to the user. And he will send that back encrypted, of course. He doesn't send it in plain. He will encrypt it using the shared key that he has with the user. So he encrypts it under that shared key, K1. He also takes that same key that he just generated and he encrypts it for the ticket granting server. He sends that also to the user. The user can't do anything with it. He knows that that is actually the encrypted K2, encrypted by a key he doesn't know, K3. He can, on the part above the arrow, there he can do decryption. He can decrypt that first message, because he has that shared key K1, and so he can find K2. The bottom part, he doesn't do anything with that. But the bottom part, he just sends straight away to the ticket granting server. And he sends to the ticket granting server his identity, but then encrypted with this key that was just generated by the authentication server. That proves, actually, later on, that he actually also has this key K2. Why? What does the ticket granting server do? He looks at the first part of the message, says, okay, that should be something that was generated by the authentication server, sent to the user. The user didn't do anything with it, and the user just forwarded it to me. So he knows, he shares a key with the authentication server, K3. He knows that that is encrypted with K3. He decrypts that, and he finds K2. The second part of that message, he knows that that was created by the user, using key K2. So he can decrypt that and he can check indeed that this is indeed the identity that is related to this key K2. So the key is not just the bits that make up the key, but it's more included, of course. This is just shorthand. So the ticket granting server can indeed now verify, yeah, I'm talking to the user who legitimately got all this information from the authentication server. And he knows that the user wants not to talk to the ticket granting server. No, the user wants to get access to the application server. So he generates a key that will be shared between the user and the application server, K5. And he encrypts that. He encrypts that for the user. Well, he has a shared key with the user, K2. Okay, so he encrypts it using K2 and sends that, so the user can indeed now find back K5, the key that he will share with the server. And he also encrypts it for the server, for the application server. Well, he has a shared key with the application server, which is K4. And so he also encrypts it in that way and sends that also to the user. Again, the user can't decrypt that. He doesn't have possession of K4. He just gets it and forwards it to the application server. And so he forwards it to the application server plus some other encrypted information, again, encrypted with that particular key K5, just again to show that he is the correct one that is sending this message. The application server will get the first message. He can decrypt that. So he finds out, first of all, the shared key, K5, that he will share with the user. The identity of the user is also in there. Okay. Then using that K5, he can look at the second message. He can decrypt that now because he has that key. And he finds some information in there. He can check that the identity is correct. He finds a value T. And he will then prove to the user that he already got this information, that he got this information in a good way by sending back an encryption again. But he just changes this T slide. He just increases the value and encrypts that and sends it back. So now the user can decrypt that last message and see, okay, yeah, I send a value T and I get a slightly increased value back. So that's correct. Yeah, so this is the way that at the very end, the goal of having the user and the application server having a shared key, this is done in this way. So this is how Kerberos works. A lot of keys, a lot of messages, but secure. When we talk about Kerberos, we talk about Kerberos Realms. What is it? It is a system, a number of devices, which include a Kerberos server, so the authentication server and the ticket granting server. There's a number of clients there that want to use this. There's a number of clients there and a number of application servers. So these clients want to use these particular application servers. So the Kerberos server knows all the identities of the user, shared key. It's trusted by all of them. Normal thing. So it's in Kerberos system. Let's put it like that. So the users can connect to the application servers in their own realm by the method that I just explained. Yeah. So you can see a Kerberos realm as a system that uses Kerberos. Now it says Kerberos realms, so plural. Okay, so there's probably more than one realm. Let's see what we have. So assume that we have two of these systems. We have Kerberos here, big system here, with the Kerberos system, the Kerberos servers here, and we have a number of clients, and we have a number of applications. Yeah, and a client could contact the Kerberos server with a number of communications going back and forth, and in the very end could get access to an application. So that's one realm. Now we have another one. And we have the Kerberos server again. And the number of users. And the number of applications. And all the same, right? And so a user here, one of these users, can get access in a secure way to one of these applications. And a user here can get access to one of these applications. Yeah, exactly as it should be. But now we talk about inter-realm communication. So there will be communication not just within these bubbles, but also between. Suppose that, let's call this B, logically, and this A. Suppose that people in this realm do trust the authentication method that is used here. So they do trust that this person here, this Kerberos server, is doing the correct things. That's the assumption we have, or that we have it on picture also. Now let's assume that this user is interested not in one of these applications, but he wants this to use this application. Can that be done? Yes, in fact, it can be done. So what he does is he first will contact the authentication server as normal, and he get a ticket granting ticket, and then he asks the ticket granting server for, yeah, normally he would get a ticket that he could use to contact an application, right? That's what we had before. But now in this case, what he will get back is something that he can use to contact the ticket granting server here. And the ticket granting server here sees that this ticket granting server allowed the user to contact him for access to this particular application. And if everything goes okay, then he says, okay, yeah, you can do that. You get your ticket granting ticket, or your application granting ticket here, and you just contact this server. So this ticket granting server doesn't have just shared key with all of these applications, and this one has shared key with all of these applications, but all of a sudden this ticket granting server and this ticket granting server should have a shared key also. Yeah, so if you think back a few slides, all the keys that were there, I could put a new ticket granting service in there, and just, yeah, it would be a few more lines going up and down. Yeah, so the four lines up there and the line going to the application, that's what was in the first picture also. But now, after getting the ticket granting ticket, before being able to access the service, you have to go through the ticket granting server here on this second realm also. That's some extra steps. Obviously, a user can now get access to more application servers, which is good. There are some extra steps in there for security. And these systems, these servers need to trust each other, of course. Yeah, otherwise that's not possible. Yeah, if this guy thinks that this one is not checking identities very well or something else is going on, he will not allow that. Clear? A lot of keys there. If you go over it and then see what actually is going on, try to follow the steps, then you'll see that yeah, pretty much works. Yeah? Let's go to certificates, X509 certificates. 3-4 weeks ago, we were talking about asymmetric crypto. We talked about certificates also. We talked about public and private keys. And actually, the private key was something that you kept secret, but the public key, that was something that we should spread out and everybody should use if they want to communicate to me. But I don't just send it out. I'll put it inside what is called a certificate. And that certificate has a signature on it saying, this is the correct key for Patrick, the correct public key for Patrick. So you know when you see that certificate, if you see my certificate, that the key in there is in fact my key. X509 is a structure to do this. Used in S/MIME, SSL, IPsec, etc., etc. There are actually a number of versions of X509. Three versions at the moment. Maybe in the future there will be more. The first version was rather short, and then more and more information was added to that. Let me see, what do you see in there? The subject name, for example, that's in this particular case, that's my name. That's showing that you are looking at a certificate that belongs to me. The issuer name, that's actually the one that signed my certificate, so my certificate authority. There is a serial number, just to have a unique number to a certificate. There is my public key is in there, of course, because this whole thing was set up to have my public key in there, so there is some algorithm and parameters and keys in there. There is something on at the top, signature algorithm, algorithm identifier. That's actually the algorithm that the CA has used to sign my certificate. So I know how I can check, what algorithms I can use to check this particular certificate. There is a period of validity. Okay, next week I want, or next month I want to use my certificate, my public key. So I'm asking for a certificate for that. And that will have a validity period starting on the 1st of November until the 30th of November. I can't use it before the 1st of November. I can just use it in November. And once the 1st of December comes, I can't use that certificate anymore. And so that really restricts that I can use that particular certificate within a particular period of time. At the very end, there is actually the signature. So you have a lot of information in there in each of these three versions. So there was some extra information in version 2 and 3. But in principle, what is done is we take that information, the CA does that, and then they sign the information. We've talked about signing in the couple of weeks ago when we talked about asymmetric cryptos. So it makes sure that you can check that actually none of the information in the certificate has changed by using the keys from the CA. Number of different certificates, I will not go into many details. The most used one is the long-lived certificate. So those are the general ones. Some more information can be found in the book. I will not go into details now. That certificate that I was just talking about, that was valid 1st of November till the 30th of November. But damn, on the 15th of November, somebody steals my private key. So I have to generate a new one. Well, if I generate a new private key, I get automatically a new public key also. They are linked together. So I have a new public key and a new certificate related to that public key. But I have a certificate that says, hey, this is the public key of Patrick, not the new one. This is the public key. And that public key is valid until the end of November. So somehow, and it's signed by my CA, so it all checks out. Validity period is 1st of November until the 30th of November. Somehow, I have to tell people, yeah, it says that it's valid in this period, but something has happened. You can't use it anymore. The information in this particular certificate, my public key in this particular certificate, can't be used anymore. So for that we have what we call revocation. We have a certificate revocation list, CRL, and in that certificate revocation list, the CA can say this particular certificate is no longer valid. There is a where is it? There is a user certificate serial number. Yeah, that's the certificate number there, nearly on the top. Yeah, so that's a link. That's a unique number, and so I can, once I get a certificate revocation list, I can see that that particular serial number is in there, so that this particular certificate should not be used anymore. It's not a single certificate that is revoked. It's always. It can be a set of certificates that can be revoked in one go. Yeah, and so I revoke a number of certificates. Yeah, this could be made by anybody. No, to make sure that it's just CA that revokes the certificates, it will sign this information again. So the top part will be signed and then the signature will be added at the end. Yeah, so if I now get a certificate of somebody and I see that the validity period is okay, I still have to check the certificate revocation list of the CA well, it's in the certificate, so I know who the CA is. I have to check the certificate revocation list of that CA and see if this particular certificate is revoked or not. If it is, I can't use it. If it doesn't show up in the certificate revocation list, I can freely use it. There. Obviously, I need to do extra work. Yeah, before, I just assumed I get the certificate. I'll check that the signature from the CA is okay, and then I can start using. Now I also have to see if maybe it's revoked or something. I have to do extra work. Heartbleed. Who has heard of Heartbleed? Okay, good. Heartbleed actually used some deficiencies in this case. In certificate revocation list. In using certificate revocation list. So not a weakness of a certificate revocation list by itself, but in most cases, people just don't check if a certificate is on a revocation list. They just use it. Okay, then I think some repetition on public key infrastructure. If I say something new, could be interesting. There are various definitions. This is a definition of RFC 4949. A set of hardware, software, people, policies, and procedures needed to create, manage, store, distribute, and revoke digital certificates based on asymmetric crypto. Yeah, it's a definition. But it is more, a public key infrastructure is an infrastructure. So it's more than just the bits and the bytes. There's people involved, there's policy involved, and everything. The goal of the PKI is to enable a secure, convenient, efficient acquisition of public keys. So PKI, a public key, a certificate. A certificate contains a public key, but it's not something that is just on itself. No, it has to be signed by a CA. And a CA has a public key. Oh, then that public key should be in a certificate. And that certificate should be signed by another CA. Yeah. It's a full infrastructure. To check the validity of the users. So to check the validity of my certificate, you have to find the CA's public key. Because that was used, the private key of the CA was used to create the signature in my certificate. Yeah, and in order to check a signature, you needed to use the public key, right? I don't go into the cryptographic details here. But because that requires the use of a public key, as I said, okay, that public key of the CA is in a certificate. And that certificate is signed by higher order CA. And in order to check this certificate, in order to be sure that the key I'm using to check my certificate is actually a valid key, I have to check all the way up, right? So it goes on and on and on. It can't go on forever, of course. So at some point at the top, there is what we call a root CA. And the root CA signs the certificates of the CAs underneath it. Okay, then if it has to sign it, it has a private key, and then a related public key, and the public key should be in a certificate. And who does sign that? Well, the one above. No, there is no one above that. It's on the top already. Well, actually, the root CA signs its own certificate. Yeah. So if we look here, the yellow ones on the bottom, those are the users generally. They got a public key in a certificate that is signed by the CA just above them. And the CAs the five CAs on that next to the bottom row, the third row from above, they have a public key which is in a certificate signed by the two CAs above there. And those two CAs have a public key and a certificate signed by the one on the top, the root CA, who has again a public key embedded in a certificate signed by himself. That's why there is a link back. Self-signed. Initially, the idea was there will be one root CA for all of the world. Obviously, that's not possible. Because here in Norway, they did not trust a higher order CA in the United States or whatever. So they didn't want them to sign the certificates. And so there were smaller PKIs that were erected. And so, yeah, each of these smaller PKIs has a root CA with a self-signed certificate. And all of these root certificates are actually collected in what is called a trust store. And there the information, if I go to the trust store and get the information out of that, I have to trust that that information is correct. That there's nothing, in principle, I could make my own fake root CA certificate and just put it there. No, I can't put it there. There is a rigorous check to be able to make sure that only really trusted organizations can put their root certificate in there. There have been, unfortunately, some compromises. Digi Notar from the Netherlands in 2011 actually got its root certificate compromised. Or I should say not the root certificate, they got a private key compromised. And so if I can get the private key of a root certificate or any CA, I can start signing my own certificates. So yeah, that was apparently a self-signed root certificate CA in that trusted list that obviously got removed once it was detected that it was compromised. That was already the last slide. Any questions? That gives me 5 minutes to say something about the assignment. Let me see, who had not heard about Heartbleed? Everybody. Okay, you are going to write a paper on Heartbleed. Probably just repetition. Heartbleed is apparently a bug in the OpenSSL library, which was detected, well, I said recently, April 2014, over 2 years ago already. There was a bug detected in open source software that had been there for quite a while already without being detected. If you want some background information, you can go to Wikipedia or you can go to heartbleed.com, where this logo also comes from. Information you find on these web pages is general information, background information. It's not scientific information. Anybody can put information on his own website. Anybody can add information to Wikipedia also. Even though there is some checking, it's never certain that this is 100% correct information. There are some scientific papers on Heartbleed also. So I did a quick search. I found three. I think they are all from November 2014, so relatively soon after this was discovered. I will give these papers to you. So you have three scientific papers on Heartbleed already, so you can learn some more. So your assignment is the following. You learn about Heartbleed. Okay, you got these three scientific papers, you study them. You find additional papers. You don't stop at three papers. Yeah, three papers is also partially the opinion of a number of people. Try to find more information, more background information, more scientific background information. Read background material. With background material, when I say scientific paper, then I'm talking about information that is peer-reviewed by the scientific community and that has been published afterwards, after a number of people have looked at this and says, this is valid information. This is correct. Yeah. So when I say find scientific information, additional scientific information, that means you have to go to sources that publish proceedings from conferences, that publish in journals, etc., etc. IEEE, ACM, these kind of trusted sources. When I say read background material, that's the Wikipedia side. That's maybe something in the newspaper. That is the Heartbleed.com website. Yeah. Anybody can write whatever they want. Not necessarily 100% correct. Not saying it's wrong, but I'm just saying it's not verified by other people. So if you find interesting information on heartbleed.com, sure, you can use this information, but you have to verify the correctness via other sources. There will be a guest lecture next week, Thomas Kemmerich. It's a colleague of mine here at the in Jøvik. He will give a guest lecture next week at 12:15. Yeah, and so you learn about Heartbleed, but that's not a real assignment. The real assignment is to write a scientific paper on Heartbleed. And again, note that I write scientific. Yeah. So what does that mean? You have to deliver a scientific paper. It should be technology related. That's one thing. This is the introduction to cyber information security technology. So write a scientific paper, not just high-level things or whatever. It's about the SSL protocol. You could see that from one of the first slides. So, okay, what is the SSL protocol? Technical details. Put them in there. Not include non-scientific, non-relevant information. Yeah, the fact that you have tried to implement Heartbleed yourself or whatever, that's not interesting. Yeah? Restrict to scientific writing. The fact that this is the first time that you write a scientific paper, maybe the first time that... Very interesting. But not inside the paper. Yeah? So keep the paper as a scientific paper. What is a scientific paper? Well, I will give you three already and you will find more so you can see what these people do and just try to mimic their style in some way. Adjust it to your own comfort, but see what these kind of people write about and do the same. The length should be 3 to 4 pages. And this is now a real restriction. So nothing below below 3 pages, nothing more than 4 pages. So think about what kind of information do I want to tell me, what you want to tell me. Make sure that it fits within these 3 pages. Yeah? If you get too much, okay, what can I remove without destroying the story that I'm telling? Yeah, so it should be a full, consistent story that you're telling. So you read at least 3 scientific papers, the ones that I give you, or you can read them. I'm not forcing you to read it, but you got 3 already, so why not use them? Follow the same style, write a logical story, that's what I said. I will provide you with a template. So not just I'm requesting 3 to 4 pages of writing. Yeah, if you use very dense writing on with very narrow margins, or you use very wide margins and double spacing and everything, yeah, then 3 to 4 pages is something very different. So that's why I provided a template. I actually provided 2 templates, one in Word and one in LaTeX. Who speaks LaTeX? Oh, I'm surprised. Very good. So use whatever, they are very, very similar. Not exactly the same, but they're very, very similar. So use whatever you prefer. But the delivery should neither be a Word file nor a text file. It should be a PDF. Yeah, in Word you can just save as a PDF or print as a PDF if you want. In LaTeX you can just compile the LaTeX code and you get a PDF also. Plagiarism. Yeah, we'll check that. What is plagiarism? You know what plagiarism is? You're all taking the course from Frode Walden. I think plagiarism was already mentioned there. So if that is detected, and we check for that, it's going automatically, so I don't need to do a lot for that, but we'll check it. But if we detect it, yeah, there will be severe consequences. That could, let's say, at the very least lead to just expelling you from this course. In the worst case, and those things have happened, we could expel you for a limited or an unlimited time from this study. So don't even try to do that. Why shouldn't you do that? Well, if you do something and you tell everybody what you have done, right? It shouldn't be me who just uses that information and then doesn't give credit to you. I can use the information. I should tell, oh, that's not mine. That's his. Kudos. Yeah? So you should give credit to the people who deserve the credit. So you can use the information that you find, the ideas that you find in the scientific papers or in other papers, whatever, even for non-academic papers. But know the value of non-academic versus academic, non-scientific versus scientific. Yeah. So you can use that if you use the proper referencing. In paper this and this, we found this and this information. You can use the ideas. You can't use sentences. So you can't just say, oh, that's nicely written. I'll just copy that sentence and put the reference behind it. No, that's not allowed. So don't do direct copying of text. That is plagiarism. If there is, in the full 3-4 pages that you're writing, if there is a single sentence that you say, oh, well, these people wrote it in an excellent way, I can't improve on that sentence writing. Okay, you copy it, you put quotes around it, you really show me that this is a quote from a paper. Yeah? But if it's more than one sentence, I'll start frowning. Yeah? Why do you have to write it in your own words? Try this. Try reading something. And when you read something, you have an idea if you understood it. If you don't understand it, you have to read it again, right? How do you know that you understood it? If you are not able to tell what you just read in your own words, then you haven't understood it. So if you read something and say, oh, okay, I'll put that in my report, and you're trying to phrase that, and you can't, okay, apparently I didn't really understand what it was about, and I'll read it again. So making sure that if you write in your own words, it's also for you a nice check if, yeah, am I just writing something down because they wrote it, or do I really understand what they are talking about? Yeah. So as soon as you are able to describe the ideas that you find in papers in your own words, you know that you understood it. I have to hurry a bit. The grading. You will get 10 points for the assignment, as for all assignments. I will, in principle, grade on the scientific content of your paper. But not following the instructions to the letter, yeah, that will reduce the grading, obviously. Part of the instructions can be found in both templates. So the templates are not empty. There is some information in there already. So check that. Yeah. Then copy and paste in that template already so you don't destroy the template. This is some wish of myself. It's nothing more terrible than having spelling errors, which are very easy for you to correct. Word has a spell checker. LaTeX, most LaTeX GUIs have spell checking also. So it's just being polite to me and the censors to just do a quick spell check once you're done before you submit. Yeah? Questions on? Yeah. Deadline will again be 3 weeks. I should have mentioned it in there. I will see if I can adjust that. Yeah? Yeah. No, there will be one more. There were 4 assignments in total. So you had crypto, you had Bloom filter, now you have Heartbleed, and there will be one more. Yeah? It will be on system security. So now we have a number of presentations on network security, then there will be a number of presentations on system security, and so that will be on that issue. Yeah, and again, there will also be a 3-week deadline, so 3 weeks for each of the assignments I had in mind. Yeah, programming might go a bit quicker than maybe reading scientific articles, so don't wait until the last day or week before to start. The articles that I provided you are 2 of them have like 14 pages, and 1 of them has 7 pages. So there is some information in there. So spend some time on reading that. Yeah? More questions? If you have questions about the assignment at any point in time, contact me or the TAs. Yeah. Okay. Then I guess that's all for today. Well, not for today. There will be exercise session. The exercise session, if I am not mistaken, will take place in, let me see here, in Startpad. Anybody knows where that is? I will join you going there. So this is a special course. You also get to see all the potential places where you can where we teach. Except Mustad. Maybe I should ask for Mustad one day. Okay, thanks.